Welcome to Dog Talk and Kitties Too. I'm Tracy Hotchner. I love people who love cats and dogs, which is why I wrote The Dog Bible, Everything Your Dog Wants You to Know, and The Cat Bible, Everything Your Cat Expects You to Know. Every week, I bring you conversations with experts and authors who share our fascination with the animals in our world. This program originated and continues for the 13th year on 88.3 WLIW-FM, Long Island's only NPR station. Dog Talk is a production of Pet Media, Inc., which is solely responsible for its content. There is a podcast library with more than 700 previous shows at RadioPetLady.com, along with my other pet talk shows like Cat Chat and Good Dogs. This show is made possible in part with the support of Woruva, a family-owned pet food company that makes high-protein recipes for cats and dogs. The show is also brought to you with the generosity of Dr. Elsie's Precious Cat, a privately owned litter and cat food company founded by Dr. Elsie, a feline-only veterinarian. My guests today are Jenna Blum, talking about her memoir, Woodrow on the Bench, Life Lessons from a Wise Old Dog. Natalia Borrega will be back talking about problem child dogs like her 130-pound Great Dane, Lysander, who has traveled the world with her. And Gabriel Feitosa will be here. He's the best-in-show winning groomer on the ABC series Pooch Perfect, but also has many other ways in which he influences people in the world. In keeping with the whole theme of the Dog Film Festival, Saving Senior Dogs Week, and the adoration and appreciation of senior dogs that has been filtering through the show, I now come upon a book, which is the fullest celebration of living with an old man dog that you will ever read. Woodrow on the Bench, Life Lessons from a Wise Old Dog, is so touching and fetching. And Jenna Blum is here to crow about this absolutely special memoir. Jenna, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I love that description.
Well, Life Lessons from a Wise Old Dog, I guess so, but it seems more like the world that you created with him is where the lessons came from. And that's what I found so touching, is that you talk about his importance to you as a primary person, if you will, in your life, with men coming and going and life coming and going, and Woodrow always being the constant. But when he got old and slowed down, I think your inventiveness in going and sitting on a bench with him was a really one-off idea, and something that I think other people might follow in your footsteps. It kind of reminded me of the old folks that, I don't know if they still do it, sit on the benches in the middle of, like, I don't know, Columbus Avenue, and they just sit there and the world goes by, but I don't know if anybody stops to talk to them. What was the moment when you thought, well, Woodrow can't do much in the way of exercise anymore, but the world is still interesting to him? When did his bench become the kind of touchstone for how you were going to live out his senior period of his life with him?
That's a great question, and I think you very kindly give me too much credit. The reason that we sat every day, morning and night, in all weathers and all seasons on this bench across from my apartment in downtown Boston is that was as far as Woodrow could get.
Yeah.
So when he was about 14, he was diagnosed with congestive heart failure, and anyone who has ever owned an old Labrador knows that their legs go even before that. Their back legs are often problematic, and so he was a heavy old guy who I'd been carrying around like an 85-pound log in a harness, even before he had that heart failure diagnosis. But that really clinched it for us. So every day I would put him in his harness and walk him down the 16 steps from my apartment to the street, cross this very busy street very, very slowly, and we would make our way over to the closest bench, and then he would womp down in this dirt patch that his body had made next to the bench over the years, and then we would just sit there. So it really wasn't anything I had planned. But what happened was that this incredible community grew up around us while we sat and sat and sat. And that was why I wrote the memoir, to pay homage to these incredible people.
And also the fact that the world around you slowed down. I think where you first captivated me was in describing crossing the street with him. You have a great sense of humor, and there were lots of funny ways of looking at your situation. But the fact that people stopped their cars and honked and tooted and waved at you instead of going, "Hey, lady, get out of the way with your old baggy dog." It was like they were saluting you, and you noticed that. And you wanted to also give them credit for giving you credit. It seemed like there was a very circular love thing that happened around the way you cared for this old man. It seemed to have touched people in the midst of a busy day behind the wheel of their car. You remark on it, and you obviously noticed, gee, that's a lot nicer than the alternative. But did you feel that in some way it touched or transformed them to see your devotion to him?
I think that's absolutely true. And what you mentioned before about the elderly people sitting on the bench in Columbus Avenue or in Central Park, I mean, we have that in my neighborhood as well. I look out my window, I look on this sort of greenway, and I see people sitting on the benches, the same people every day who probably can't get very far, like my dog. But you're quite right that without the dog as sort of conversational currency and a love binder, it's hard for people to know how to jump across that conversational void. But when you introduce a dog into the mix and the kind of love that people have for their animals, all of a sudden the equation totally changes into one of being connected. And So I'm somebody who, you know, grew up in New Jersey, learned to drive there. Hence, I have a mouth like a sailor, you know, born in New York, had been crossing this busy avenue that my apartment is on my whole life without the old dog, even with a young dog. You know, people were like, "Get out of the way," and honking and swearing at me, you know. But when I had my old boy, it was like magic. I could step into the middle of the street at rush hour, you know, terrified that we were going to get squashed like bugs. And instead, what would happen is people would stop and they'd say, "Hey, good job, dog. You know, you got this, buddy." And sometimes they would literally stop their cars to hold up the traffic.
Yes.
So that we could limp across the street. And it was so extraordinary for me to see that kind of goodwill, not just one day, not just two, but consistently for my old Woodrow.
And what about the treat jar? Not the one you do after he passes away at the end, but the treat jar that was out there, the bucket. I mean, that was like the craziest idea I've ever heard. And whose invention was that? Tell about that, because that was really quite another revelation of sort of community kindness and goodness towards dogs.
So fantastic, right? Everywhere that I have lived with a dog has proven to reveal these magic communities of goodwill. I had it when Woodrow was young in his first dog park. That was an impromptu dog park. It wasn't official, but people would gather there with their dogs every day. And then I relocated to a different area in Boston called the Back Bay, where I now live. Attached to one of the park benches about five blocks from my apartment is something called the treat bucket. It's like a little rubbish bin that's attached to one of the benches with a bicycle lock. And it says, "Good dog, sit," on the top. And the neighbors keep it filled with treats. And nobody knows which neighbor does it. Like, that's not the point. The bucket is always filled with treats. And the dogs know, believe me. So when Woodrow was 14, when he could still walk very slowly, all of a sudden, he would be humping down the street, you know, dragging his harness behind him because he's like, "Mama, we have to get to the treat bucket. The dog is starving." So we would go there every day. And sometimes it would take like an hour to get down there, you know, and then like 2 hours to get back. But the dog was happy. The dog got treats. And every dog in the neighborhood knew that bucket. So after Woodrow passed, I did the same thing on his bench. I ordered a bucket and a bike lock and attached it to Woodrow's bench with a picture of him on the front that said, "In memory of Woodrow, who loved this bench, please enjoy a treat for your dog." And literally, I'm looking out my window at it right now, and there is a dog getting a treat.
Cut it out. Cut it out.
Yeah, absolutely true. I mean, I would invite every reader of Woodrow on the Bench to come to downtown Boston to the Back Bay on the Commonwealth Mall. You will see the bucket because you'll see all the dogs going to the bucket. It is an amazing phenomenon.
It's an amazing idea. And somehow, I don't know why, it creates such an emotional response in a dog lover, in a reader. certainly in me, but I know that it's a universal response, like, oh my God, that's so sweet. That's so generous. That's so thoughtful. That's so dog-centric. And how do you keep the dog from eating everything that's in there? You know, like, how hard is it to yank them away? Yes, of course, if they're going to come to Boston, they should go see Woodrow's bench, clearly. I mean, Woodrow on the bench is now a thing. But how about making a treat bucket in your own community? I mean, how many communities do you think the treat bucket would survive in? I mean, obviously, people don't want to steal what's in it. So I guess the goodness of the heart is simply you bicycle lock so they don't take the bucket because they need a bucket. But do you think it would work anywhere?
I do. And that's one of the things that struck me so much when Woodrow was in his dotage. I would sit on the bench and post Instagram and Facebook posts about his experience from his point of view, of course. So it's like all these sorority ladies came to see me, or like these people came to see me. And the response that I got from people online was so galvanic. They would say, my community needs a bench. My community needs a bucket. Like everybody needs these communal yes. gathering places of goodwill. And that was part of the reason I knew that I had put my finger inadvertently on something that was even bigger than my old dog, even bigger than dog love, which was the need for community, especially in a time of such national and international division. People mm-hmm. were so hungry to see these gestures of goodwill and so hungry for a way to bring people together. So I think whatever community people are in, that the buckets are like the little lending libraries that people have outside of their homes, except for dogs. And I will tell you that from the city historical society, which is very strict in Boston, they should not have permitted the bucket to remain on the bench, but they did. And even, you know, people who have never encountered it before come along the street and I hear them crying out, oh my God, look, it's so sweet. It's a bucket for an old dog. It's bucket treats for dogs. So I think that from the highest to the lowest, like echelon of people who should be getting rid of the bucket or sort of, you know,
turning a blind eye. Yes.
Yeah,
politely.
Nobody ignores it. Nobody besmirches it. Like everybody respects the bucket and it makes people happy every day. And I'm so privileged to be able to watch that magic happen.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. I think that one of the charms of the book, it has many charms, but one of the charms is the way you channel his voice. And it's pretty hilarious. It's a very hard, I think, line to toe, to not make him sound too cute or too goofy or too fakey. You really captured this guy, Woodrow. I mean, I really felt all the time that, and a lot of chuckles. I mean, he was very funny, which is absurd, obviously, because you're the one who was funny. But you imbued him with a personality and a character and a kind of tenacity, even in his old age. He's like, I can do this. We'll be okay. It's all right. And the caring for an old dog, which is something that you did almost to a fault, in my opinion, is part of, I think, what's so touching is that physical caretaking of him when he had poop explosions or he couldn't hold his pee or he threw up. And you're always saying to him, it's okay, everybody throws up a little bit sometimes. It's just, you know, it's sort of, we don't have old people in our homes very much anymore. And we all feel, I'm saying we, the collective we, whatever that means, feel guilty to put older people into assisted living or nursing homes because we don't have a society where there is somebody who stays home all the time and could look after the older handicapped human. But you did it for a dog because you're a writer and you were able to accommodate your schedule to him. How much do you think people are projecting their own wish that they could do that for a human or that another human could do it for them when they're old and infirm and kind of cripply?
What a terrific question. I think for humans, we have options that exist that don't necessarily exist for dogs. So as you pointed out, for our elders who might be failing physically, there are communities and homes that we can put them in for
right.
lack of a more elegant phrase,
right.
That we can find places for where there are professional caretakers to help them with poop explosions and with medication
yes.
and with their physical needs. But that doesn't exist for dogs. So what happens is most people, if they have their dog having difficulty with his back legs, will put the dog down.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I know I went way above and beyond doing that with Woodrow. He was not just struggling with mobility, but he was incontinent toward the end, and he did have massive poop explosions. My editor's like, we have way too much poop in this book. And I'm like, I know, but that's what happens with old dogs and old people. Like, it's a thing. And I'll be interested in reader reaction and hearing from readers. What did they think that I took it too far? Did they think it was extreme? Would they do the same thing? But usually, again, what happens is with older dogs, you don't have the option, so you either put them down or you struggle along and do the deep internet dive into, should my dog have a wheelchair?
Right,
should my
right.
dog have diapers? How do you handle this? And there really was not a lot of guidance. I did find, of course, like wheelchairs for dogs, harnesses for dogs, perambulators for dogs, diapers for dogs. Like, there is an industry out there, but there isn't really a sort of a community bulletin board where you can go and get help from people. And I hope that something that Woodrow on the Bench does is functions as a lightning rod for pet owners with old dogs who are not willing to put their dogs to sleep simply because their legs don't work anymore and who are struggling with these challenges, but the dogs still retain their personality. As you point out, Woodrow did. Like, the dog is still intact in his soul and his psyche and enjoying the treats, and the tail still works. So how do you focus on getting help with the other challenges? I am so here to help people with that because I want to help them have the same experience I did of enjoying their dog to the very last week.
Which is lovely. And the Saving Senior Dogs Week, which has 25 group senior dog rescues and sanctuaries as members, and there's another 25 that didn't join this year, but we know they will down the road. It's called a week, but it's really obviously around the clock, 24/7, 52 weeks a year, for as long as these old guys and gals hang in there. They have lots of ways to help provide support for people so they don't give up their dog either to those rescues or shelters or to a municipal one, in which case it's definitely a death sentence. I guess, you know, I tread lightly to say that I personally think you went too far at the end. I think that you had talked in the book very intelligently about this whole, the whole scale that's now been developed. Is the dog having quality of life? And his quality of life had pretty much ended. And then he was, you know, very ill and schlepped to the serious doctor who said, we really need to end this suffering now. And you were bound and determined to somehow get him back home and back up those stairs and have a ritual that meant a great deal to you. And it's the only time in the book when I thought, wow, Jenna, this is too much for him. It means something to you, but this is tough on him. But you didn't feel that way in the book, and you were very honest and genuine throughout the book, for which I really admired you, knowing how much he meant to you and how much your idea of how his life should be and how his life should end mattered to you. Did you, after writing it and after living it, think maybe I went too far, or are you sure that's what you needed to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I respect your candor. And I think you've said this in like a really nice way so that I don't feel scolded in some
way.
And I know
that's what I want.
Right? Exactly. Because the experience that people have with their dogs and the experience of that bond is so individual. I think
yes.
we each have to make our choices. So that I would also not look askance at people who said, this is too much for me to handle.
Right.
My dog is in pain. His
right.
legs have gone. He's
right.
not happy anymore. I need to help him cross the river. I would never question that decision on anybody's part. And I understand if people do question it on my part. I absolutely 1,100%, not good at math, stand by the way that I helped
good.
Woodrow.
Good.
I feel really good about it. If
good.
Anything, I think the last week of his life, when he wasn't eating, like my mantra had always been, and I mentioned this in
right.
Woodrow on the Bench,
yes.
the Anna Quinlan thing about putting her own dog down, which is if the nose and the tail still work, then I'm keeping my dog alive.
Right.
And right up to that last week, Woodrow was still able to be outside enjoying his sniffs and wagging
yep.
his tail at people. His appetence was okay. And then that very last week, it was like a precipitous slide and I knew what was coming. When he was in the hospital at the very, very end, and I won't include a spoiler here for readers, but the vet wanted to put him down at the hospital. And this old guy had such a special life and so many people who loved him, and his home and his bench and his bed with all of his toys meant so much to him, that I just said, please just let me take him home. And I managed to do that in a way that was not causing him pain.
No,
he
it
was
didn't.
On a lot of medication. So,
well, I'm appreciative of you answering that candidly, and we have run out of time, but I just wanted to say it because everyone's going to read the book and they're going to read it to the end. It's incredibly captivating. But when you get there, I mean, I have strong opinions and information about all kinds of things on this show. And I just wanted to say that for me, it would have been too much for my dogs, not for me personally, but for my dogs. But as you say, mutual respect for the way somebody else lived with their dog and lets their dog die is really important. And I love what you've done with this book. I love the way you lived with him. And I wish you a wonderful, long, long, equally long life with your new dog. So Jenna Blum, Woodrow on the Bench, Life Lessons from a Wise Old Dog is a gem. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. And every week is Saving Senior Dog Week, people. So please, please, please adopt senior dogs. They are the best.
Wonderful. This show is supported in part by Meet Me, a privately owned farm in Virginia that makes raw frozen foods and dehydrated treats for cats and dogs using animals raised on their own farm. This show is also brought to you by Merrick Pet Food, which began as a family-run company in Texas 30 years ago, where they are still making natural pet food. I am back with Natalia Borrego. Remember, I talked to her a month or so ago about her being the co-host of this great PBS digital show called Animal IQ. She's a researcher and a brainiac about particularly lions, but also lots of other animals. And after we finished our interview, it turned out that Natalia and I share a problem child dog. Well, we don't have the same dog. Hers is a Great Dane and mine is Wanda the Weimaraner. But Natalia, welcome back. It is so great to have a chance to discuss with you what it's like to have a dog who has certain issues. You know, people, it's funny, people use euphemisms, you know, issues. What does that mean exactly? And you charmingly called your gigantic Great Dane, Lysander, you called him a problem child. But what did you mean by that? And what do you think as an animal researcher, expert, observer, knowledgeable person? Talk about what it's like to be the mom of a gigantic dog who has issues. And I really wanted to have this conversation so that people have a chance to feel that they're not alone if their dog has issues. And they can also get a great dog trainer, sometimes even remotely. But that we understand that those dogs come into our lives. And how do we deal with it? How do we frame it? What words do we use about it? And what do we do about it? So you are, you know, you're an academic, which I adore, but you also are in the field. I mean, you sit in a cage in South Africa or Botswana and watch the social behavior of lions. What if you were to do that with your Great Dane? Wouldn't that be so funny?
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm so happy to be able to talk about this because, you know, being an animal expert, quote unquote, I've clicker trained a lion to let me scoop saliva out of its mouth.
No
and yet,
kidding.
Yet here I am with this, you know, 120, 130 pound dog who has behavioral issues. He's very anxious. He is really scared of other dogs and can be aggressive. So that's something that I have really had to work with. I do call him my problem child. I love him dearly. But it's difficult when you're an expert. People expect you to just kind of have this perfectly behaved dog.
Yes.
But, you know, dogs have their own personalities. They have their own fears. And my dog just happens to be kind of an anxious dog. He gets scared really easily. So trainers and getting experts in dog behavior. I'm going to do a shameless plug, Golden Rule dog training. Elaine Berg has been amazing. She's worked with me remotely. I also have local dog trainers. We travel a lot. Lysander has lived in South Africa, in New York, in Egypt, and in Germany now.
Wow.
And it's just having that support system of trainers has been huge because I might be an expert in lions, but I'm certainly not an expert in dog behavior, especially when it comes to dog aggression. So I guess my main thing that I want to tell people is it's okay if your dog isn't perfectly behaved.
Yes.
There are resources. Get a trainer. Positive reinforcement is huge. a trainer who is trained in positive reinforcement, who has experience with whatever issue your dog is experiencing, has been so helpful to help me and my dog live a happy life, even though he has these issues.
Well, I must say my hat is off to you many times over that you can travel at all with a 130-pound dog. I mean, holy cow, and you have to be so careful about that. You must have to have a custom crate for one thing.
Yes.
they don't make crates Lysander size. People, of course, do travel with Great Danes, and they do take them on airplanes. You know, a lot of the show Great Danes are huge. But to take a dog who has fear issues and then be so concerned about, oh, my God, am I making it worse by putting him in the belly of a plane and new places, new smells. And yet you're doing it. You're doing it together. And I think it's wonderful that you don't let that stop you and don't have you think, well, you know, maybe I need to leave him home in America with somebody. It's not, quote unquote, fair to him, but he's your family member. And part of life is embracing the challenges and trying to mitigate those situations that make life harder, whether it's for another human family member or a four-legged one. I think it's fabulous that you're doing that with him. One of the things that you and I talked about, and I've mentioned before on the show, is Wanda Weimaraner was a rare puppy to raise. I hadn't raised a puppy because it was politically incorrect, frankly, for decades. And I was went to rescue a golden retriever after Roma died, after her many trips from California to Italy, talk about putting dogs in the belly of a plane and then another plane. So guys, it isn't cruel. You just have to really be vigilant about which airline and, you know, be checking in all the time. Yeah. Is he on board? Is he okay? But that's for another time. Wanda, I got as a puppy for a variety of reasons, most particularly that my most recent of many rescued Weimaraners, Maisie, really didn't like other dogs. Now, she didn't attack them, but she really didn't like them. And once when I tried to adopt another Weimaraner, a male, into the house, turned out to be actually a bonkers dog, and the woman who was trying to rehome him had lied. She turned on me when I tried to kind of force urge her to check him out. I thought, okay, she's going to have to pick the dog from birth. She could raise the dog. And that worked wonderfully. But then, of course, here I am raising Wanda with all the things you're supposed to do right. Oh, you know, strange people, strange situations, strange noises, you name it. She hit puberty and she just changed. She became fearful, which made no particular logical sense. I waited to spay her until she was over a year old, which is really essential for health, especially for a large breed dog. So theoretically, she should have been stable and sturdy mentally. And she just decided other dogs were danger. Nothing bad had ever happened to her. And we can talk about Lysander, who did have two bad things happen to him. And he has every reason to fear and want to drive away other dogs. But I have to live with that all the time. And we're in an off-leash world by choice. But that means that anytime I see a dog or she hears or sees a dog, she gets positive reinforced to come back to me, and then we go in the opposite direction as quickly and clearly as possible, away from the danger. Otherwise, she will try to drive the dog away. Mm-hmm. So talk about Lysander and what happened to him in Central Park.
Yes. So I, like you, did everything right. Puppy classes, socialization, new experiences, everything you're supposed to do. Right. And he unfortunately ended up being attacked not once, but twice. And dogs go through different fear phases when they're growing up. And he was attacked when he was, you know, right before puberty, during what was probably his second fear phase. And it really just kind of stuck with him. Mm-hmm. He was already... So he's very funny. He's very alert about his surroundings, and he just has somewhat of an anxious disposition. So, for example, if you move a piece of furniture and he doesn't see you move it, he will react and bark at it when he sees it. I had a neighbor in Egypt who had put plants up on his porch, and Lysander could see the plants through the window. And he really freaked out one day because my poor neighbor put up these new plants, and, well, those are new, and they didn't get Lysander.
No kidding.
Yeah, so we had to walk him over. My neighbor had to come out and say, no, these are okay. So he has kind of a natural disposition to be a little bit anxious. And so just having those two negative experiences with the dogs really kind of set it in his head that dogs are to be scared of. And because of his size, a lot of dogs see him and don't react in a friendly way.
Correct.
And so that reinforces it more. So it's similar when we're on walks. I have treats with me. In Germany, it's also a lot of off-leash dogs. I do walk Lysander with a gentle leader, which is the best, it's the safest for him and for other dogs. And if we see another dog, it's avoid, it's treat and walk away the same as you. And it's difficult because you feel a lot of times that people are judging you. But you just have to remember that you need to do what is best for the safety of your dog. You are your dog's companion. You're their parent. You are their advocate in this world. And so it really was a challenge for me to realize people are going to maybe not agree with having a gentle leader on him, or if I have a basket muzzle on him, but that's the safest for them and it's the safest for him. And I need to do what is best for him. I've consulted trainers and experts that have told me that this is okay. And so you just need to know that you are doing what is best for your dog.
It's very smart. On basket muzzle, I invested in one too. The Italians make what's, I think, the most comfortable basket muzzle, although there's a British company that makes one too. Mm-hmm. In Italy, at some point, I forget when we were living there, muzzles were expected on any dog. And all the dogs are leashed when they're walked in Italy. There's no off-leash, at least in my experience, city or country. But muzzling a dog is considered average, normal on any dog, just kind of like a general safety. But in the United States, you rarely, if ever, see a muzzle. So you're sending this message, my dog is dangerous. No, actually, your dog could be the one that sets my dog off. And I don't know how else to tell you that and how to keep your dog safe. It's a complicated thing. Someone actually once submitted a film, a British woman submitted a film to the Dog Film Festival. I wish it had been a little shorter and a little lighter spirited, but it was all about it's okay to muzzle your dog for the very reason you talked about, and how people in public in certain societies have a very negative reaction to a muzzled dog. But you're really doing it to keep everybody safe. You know, I mean, what if you had a dog that reacted badly to children? I've had that dog just sees children as an absolute threat. They look different. They run differently. Their voices are different. They smell different. So you muzzle the dog. You don't let the child near the dog because you don't want to rile up the dog, but just in case. And certainly on a big dog, and Weimaraners are big too, and not to me, but to some people, they look scary, almost like the Doberman Pinscher looks scary. So if you muzzle them, you're sending a kind of a message. It's fine with me, like stay away, you know, because that's really what you want to do anyway, is like, get away, please. No, my dog does not want to play with yours. I think the idea of working with a trainer is really important. I look forward to having Ellen, is it, from the Golden Rule?
Oh, Elaine.
To join me and talk about managing aggressive dogs, which doesn't mean, you know, fighting monster dogs. It means dogs whose reaction to other dogs is to be on the attack, even if they don't attack. It's I mean, Wanda will actually drive them away as if she is the opposite of herding a sheep, you know, not like friendly, keep them together. It's like drive them away as fast as you can. And almost every dog will turn tail and run, even if they've come at her in a threatening way. So that's good, as long as they get the message. But that's not really, you don't want to put her in that position where she has to be that hypervigilant. I do think it's really important that people, if you can work with a good trainer near you, then you could have a telephone conversation where you can pay them. You should pay trainers. You don't just use their time on the phone to say, you know, we worked on this, we took your advice, and here's what happened. What could we have done differently or better? And I think that's the value of having that sounding board. Amy Sadler has been that with me forever. You know, you find yourself in a situation where you thought you had it figured out, and now it's a new situation. Let's say it's a small dog comes to Lysander from behind, and you're unaware of it. There was a guy behind me on a hiking trail The minute I saw him, because he was coming fast down the trail with a dog that was on a leash and didn't look the least bit friendly, which wouldn't even matter to Wanda, I put her on a leash and tried to make her go quickly, but she kept whipping around to look at him. Yeah. And I said, "My dog's not friendly." He said, "Oh, neither is mine." I'm like, "Okay, could you give me some room? You're tailgating me." He said, "We have to get back to our car." I said, "Can you give me some space? Do you want to walk past me?" "No, that wouldn't be a good idea." It's like, duh, come on. You know, for everyone's sake, like, think like a dog. Give me space. Don't crowd me, right?
Yeah.
So in Germany, in general, what is the street etiquette for dogs?
So dogs in Germany, in my area, none of them are leashed at all, which is really tricky with Lysander. Yes. And they all have these lovely behaved dogs.
Oh, my God.
And here I'm walking mine. And so it's quite a foreign concept to them to have a giant dog who is dog aggressive. Luckily my neighbors, I have, two neighbors in my building have dogs. I've talked to them. They've been lovely and understanding. And so if they see me, the word has gotten out to just give us a wide berth. I have to be vigilant, just to make sure that, you know, an unleashed dog who's used to friendly dogs doesn't come running up to my dog who is not friendly.
Oh my gosh. I would be carrying a cane and shoo, away. No, really. Because if people are expecting something different than your reality and they don't have voice control over their dog and you're in a foreign country and you don't want to be, you know, the ugly American or the ugly foreigner saying, get your dog away in German, whatever the nice way is to say that. And even that might sound just horrible to their ears, since apparently I've never heard of this thing of all these loose dogs. But there you go. I mean, it works for them. It works for their dogs. It is really a tricky one. And wow, you got your hands full and yet you're managing. I think that's terrific. I do just want to say to people, still try to get your reactive dog. I think reactive is the best word, because Lysander doesn't want to bite anybody. He just wants them to leave him alone and give him space. Mm-hmm. He's been bitten. He's been attacked. And, you know, on the other hand, Maisie was attacked at 9 months old, weeks after I adopted her, in a bush at a camp where you're supposed to go with your dog and have fun. And one of the staff dogs decided to attack her, full on bite attack her throat, her chest. And do you know, that isn't what makes her be disinterested in other dogs. She just isn't interested in other dogs and she doesn't want them to come over and bug her. Leave me alone. So, and she, it's funny, you know, as you say, they're all individuals. They have individual personalities. And even a woman who can sit amongst tigers and lions, well, probably not tigers, but I think that would be cool too, lions, has to be more vigilant on some level with her beautiful Great Dane than with a lion. Natalia, thank you for coming and sharing your story and his story and for giving us all a good perspective on what it is to be a wonderful dog guardian.
Thank you so much. I'm just glad to be able to say that it's okay to have a dog that has reactivity and it is manageable. It takes a village, but it can be done.
Exactly. This show is also brought to you by Evermore Pet Food, privately owned by two women who make cooked dog food frozen in pouches shipped directly to your home. The show is also supported by Earth Animal Holistic Pet Wellness Products, privately owned by Dr. Bob and Susan Goldstein. I have such a cool guest today, Gabriel Feitosa. He is Brazilian. He's an extraordinary dog groomer. I mean, really amazing. I learned about him because he's one of the stars of a ABC hit reality competition show called Pooch Perfect, which is pretty amazing, the things that dog groomers can turn dogs' fur into. But Gabriel's a really extraordinary person, which is why I was really glad to have him on the show. Gabriel, you have come a very long way from being basically an orphan with your sister in the favelas of Brazil to being, I guess, an international star dog groomer. It must be a little daunting to you to think, God, I was like a street kid and now I'm at kind of the top of the world in a field that is pretty amazing. Do you wake up every day and think, where I'm in San Diego? Is this where I'm supposed to be?
I have a lot of like, oh my God, what the hell moments.
You know, I'm like,
how did I got here?
I believe it.
That's for sure. It's really unbelievable, to be honest. It's literally happens almost every day, you know, almost every day that I get to work and I see my store or some of the dogs that I'm doing right now. I just think like, wow, is this my life really right now? You know,
it's so wonderful. I know that you're also a spokesperson for Latinos, I guess, although I'm not totally clear if Brazil is considered Latino, but also the LGBTQ field the dog grooming field has a lot of LGBTQ people in it, both dog grooming and dog showing. And I know you feel that in some ways, maybe you're a spokesperson. Is that saying it correctly?
Yes, I'm really proud of being able to, because, you know, dog grooming is pretty much a underdog class, literally.
Is it really? Is it considered like not so great?
Yeah, well, I think now we have more recognition as artists and people respect more what we do. But, you know, a long time ago, when I started, it was more the kind of thing like, oh, I'm going to take my dog because it's really dirty to get shaved. It's the kind of thing that somebody would do, like drop out of school, you know, or at least that's what people would think that it was. But it's really a passion, you know, like throughout the whole dog world, there's several paths that you can go. You can go to the dog show, you can do dog grooming, and it's all involved on aesthetic of dogs. And it requires a lot of like time and knowledge because it's literally a craft, you know, it's hard on your body. You need to work really hard to learn. It's very technical and you're sculpting something that is moving. I'm really proud because tying back to what you asked, representing this class, you know, and being, you know, dark skin, coming from Brazil, being gay. And I feel like I can reach a lot of different people that want to be represented, you know, want to be recognized, just like I wanted to be. Yes. I wanted to have someone to look up and be like, oh my God, you know, that guy came from nowhere and he made all of this because he was crazy passionate about dogs. And I hope that I can be that person for someone.
It's funny, but in looking, and I'm going to put a link to, I guess, I don't know, what is the coolest part of your social media feed? Is it TikTok? I looked at a lot of the shots on TikTok of you grooming dogs, either just people's own dogs, and God, they're so beautiful. Purebred dogs, but I'm sure you do lots of mutts and make them look really interesting too. But of course, this creative dog grooming that I guess you sneak it into your pet-owned population by giving, in one case, a gray poodle these sort of tie-dyed ears. But it seems to me you have a star quality that you just have. Uh-huh. You're not faking it. You have star quality. And when I think of the fact that your mother abandoned you and your sister, and you're living, I guess, in the street in Brazil. Those of us who haven't been there, we sort of hear, oh my God, the street children, they sniff glue and they have to, you know, be prostituted or their child labor. I don't know. It just seems so horrendous. And here you were, probably you had a star quality as a little boy, but it's this drive to do something with your life and to become something. It propelled you this far. Is pretty extraordinary. And I do think it's inspirational to brown children, people, non-white people, or people that didn't start out with anything. How about less than anything? It's so great that you can do that. And you also give back to children back in Rio de Janeiro, right? I mean, you're part of a group that is teaching the martial arts in a way to feel good about themselves.
Yeah, it really is. It can be really rough, you know, for some kids in Brazil, because you know, we don't have, when you're born in a poor area in Brazil, you don't have a lot of examples around you,
right,
of how far you can go or the potential you have. But you know, I guess I was really fortunate to fall in love with dogs, which really kept me in the right path, because I was so obsessed with dogs that I didn't have time to do anything else. And I was just, you know, after school, dogs. And then eventually I stopped going to school just to do dogs. Then I had to get back to it. So I, and there's a lot of kids like that. And this project that we work with, which is the Fight for a Kid, is a project that keeps the kids from out of the streets, and they go, they have to go to learn martial arts every day. So they're not out in the streets and their family doesn't need their help to bring food home. So by being there, they get, you know, sponsored with, you know, food for the month and like a fee. And, nice. And all they have to do is to just go every day. And then they can help their family and they don't have to work for it, because it really is very easy, you know, when you're young and you don't know really what you're going to do, to get, you know, those easy offers, you know, drugs and traffic and all
yes.
of that. I'm actually from Sao Paulo, but, you know, it's not very different than Rio. And to be honest.
Well, what's interesting to me is that I would think that children living in abandoned streets full of orphans, if you will, or a street with orphans on it, that dogs would not necessarily be the first thing you turn to as, oh, my buddy, you're all just struggling to survive along with the dogs. Are there a lot of street dogs in the favelas that are just as basically abandoned and abused as the children?
Most of those kids do have families.
Oh, they do.
But the problem is, the problem is because, you know, lack of education, or sometimes the families need help because they can't like support themselves. The kids start working young, or they start doing whatever they need to bring money home, you know,
yes.
like, or asking for money it's not just the fact of the kids, they're orphans. It's a lot of kids with families and without families that happen. But with the dog relationship, it's not the first thing that someone would turn into. However, now Brazil became one of the biggest grooming industries in the world. We have like a huge industry. The professionals are very, very passionate about dogs.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's actually the third biggest pet industry worldwide after United States and United Kingdom.
Wow.
Yeah. And people now in any middle class, you know, that
right.
came up in the last 10 years have a lot of beautiful dogs, and they groom their dogs every week. And I have to say they groom their dogs even more sometimes than here. But, you know, a whole group of groomers came up with this class because a lot of people found that as first a creative outlet, and second, you know, it's a great business. So it helped a lot of people, like it helped me. So the grooming industry there it's really huge. We have grooming classes, grooming shows, where there is 2,000 people in the audience watching
kidding.
A groomer. A grooming demonstration on the stage, teaching them how to groom, how to make their clients better. How to sell a service. It's really, really cool.
How
to see the
fabulous. Boy, is that different than the United States. I mean, I go to pet industry conventions, which is what they are, right? Like Super Zoo and Global Pet Expo. And there is a day or two that is the grooming competition. And it is a world apart and kind of like stepping onto another planet, because there are
just
a few of you, a handful, call it 6 or 8 or 10, and they're all different divisions. And most of you pick white dogs, but you start out with a clean white dog. And right in front of everybody's eyes over a period of a day or two, and as you said, physically demanding on your feet and bending over, and I can't imagine, I watch your scissor action on TikTok, is really worth people looking at. Think, oh my God, that's much more work than a human hair cutter. So many little clips to get it just the perfect shape. And then out comes a dog that looks not like a dog, not like even something alive. And yet the dogs are fine with it. You know, people think, oh, that's so cruel. The poor dog. The dogs love it.
Yeah.
They didn't love it. They wouldn't stand on the table, right? And you groomers are often giving your dogs a little kiss or a little pat while working. I see that a lot on your TikTok. You give kisses a lot. And one of your dogs, which is so hilariously funny, we have to put on social media, we'll put a link to it. One of these little dogs falls asleep while you're grooming them. They're so relaxed. They like the attention so much. And you obviously also have a kind of vibe that dogs really respond to. Little dogs standing up, falling asleep like a horse asleep on his feet.
Yeah.
So cute.
Dogs really respond to energy. And I, when I hire people, and that's actually what I look for the most, is that I feel like everybody can, you know, learn how to groom. Everybody can learn the techniques aspects of it. But you need to have a way to connect with them, because it's not just being patient. You're not just being tolerant, I would say. You need to have the right kind of patience, because if the dog is anxious, or they give you like, you know, they're scared, or they give you like an anxious energy, you need to be able to receive that and neutralize it.
Wow.
So it doesn't go back to it. Because otherwise, you're just going in a snowball. You know, the dog is anxious and you're anxious.
Right.
And the dog is anxious and you get more anxious. And then it just gets stressful. So you need to be able to get that and neutralize it right away. Because the dog is calm, because they need to feel that you're confident in what you're doing, and they need to feel safe.
Nice.
So that's something very important. And that's an ability that a lot of the good groomers has to have. And, you know, to being a groomer, you need to be the kind of person that A, has an artistic talent to, like, you know, draw or arts, because it literally is all about shapes and
color.
Structure.
Yeah, and structure,
and then,
right.
Yeah, and then color and taste. But at the same time, you need to be the kind of person that is resilient, that you need to stick with it for a long time to actually get good at it.
That's right.
And you need to have, you know, discipline and the confidence to not listen to other people when they're like, why don't you stop doing that and go to college?
Right,
you know?
Right.
But then you get to a point that you're proud of it, because then you become an artist that do something that very few people can.
That's a really good point. It is a very select few. The show Pooch Perfect has lots of funny moments, and, you know, being reality TV, they have to pump up the kind of the interpersonal stuff too. But watching what you guys create with the dogs, you won Best in Show with a small, I guess it was a Bichon Frise, I think.
Yes.
Maybe it was a poodle. Yeah. I think it was a Bichon that you turned into a goldfish, so to speak, which is, you know, just saying it sounds odd, but looking at it is a huge wow factor. I love the idea of neutralizing a dog's anxiety. This is something a lot of us could think about, and think about how to do that. I think some of it comes naturally. It's a gift you have, but it's probably something that can be learned too. The idea of not amplifying a negative emotion of a dog. I did have a friend who had chocolate standard poodles, and once I was visiting her, and she was dropping the dog off at a groomer, and the dog on the way there was salivating and panting and shaking. It was a perfectly otherwise calm dog. And I said, you can't take the dog here. We're going to take the dog home. We'll put her in the bathtub. We'll give her a bath. And I don't know, we'll find some clippers, or we'll get a scissor. You can't take her someplace that makes her that nervous, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's anyone who has a groomer who is a good groomer, the dog looks forward to it. They're getting a lot of pampering.
Yeah.
It's a positive experience.
Well, It's supposed to be there's things that we can do to sensitize them at home, which, you know, like you can get an electric toothbrush and massage it on their ears, because, you know, it's loud, there's a vibration, they can like get used to the clippers, for example. But there is a lot of that is also separation anxiety. Some dogs, they can look nervous when the owner is leaving them, just because they're anticipating that the owner is going to leave.
Right.
So it's just like when sometimes you're at home and you're starting to like put your clothes on and your dog starts pacing.
Yes.
Or some dogs pee. Like right when you're about to leave, they pee or they poop because they know you're going to come back. It can be a little bit manipulative when it comes to that. But it's very important too, when you find a person that you trust and you like, stick to a schedule and go to that person always. Because we develop a relationship with the dogs. Just like a person, just like meeting someone that, you know, you grow that person, let's say you become friends with that person over time, you become friends with the dogs too. So they come to the shop over time and they know you, and they're comfortable walking in because they know what's going to happen. They know that.
And they know that it's going to be a positive experience. Gabriel, we've run out of time. I know that we can't send anybody to your dog grooming shop in San Diego. You have a waiting list as long as your arm. But Gabriel Feitosa is a wonderful person and a great role model to so many people. And the ABC series on which he stars, Perfect Pooch, Pooch Perfect, that you can look at on Hulu or ABC On Demand and so forth, is wonderful. Gabriel, thank you so much for being here. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the guests as much as I did. Kiss your kitties and hug your pooches, and we will talk again next week. Bye for now.